Not all scientific research for the military involves strategy, weapons, and killing. Rather, it also includes investigations, research on things to keep people alive. We will talk about this science with our guest author this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And we will hear about some of the military experiments involving flame-resistant textiles, shark repellent, chicken guns, and more as we explore the curious science of people at war. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So are you in the military or have you been in the military? What do you know about the science the military is involved in? What do you make of some of these scientific breakthroughs? We'll ask you to react to those as well. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Mary Roach, who is the New York Times best-selling author of many books, including Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, and others. Her latest book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And she joins us from California. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what interested you about the military science that's trying to keep people alive?
Well, more broadly, I just got interested in military science when I was reporting a story in India on the world's hottest chili pepper. And in the course of reporting that story, I heard about a project by the Indian Defense Ministry to make a non-lethal weapon out of this chili pepper. So I found that intriguing. I ended up at this lab, military lab in India, where they were working on leech repellents and, of course, the exploding chili pepper. And I just, at that point, realized military science was a little broader than I had thought. I, of course, thought of it just as weapons and bombs and strategy, and so that was what planted the seed, and then I started looking into it, and this is where I ended up.
Yeah, I had no idea. Truly, you think of the research being done is more on how to, you know, I don't know, kill more efficiently, and this is a lot different. What does this chili pepper do?
Well, it's similar to a pepper spray. It's a very, very hot chili pepper, and so they made a powder of it, and they put it into sort of a bomb that would go off. It's like a flea bomb, of course. You know, it would clear a room, that kind of thing. It's a non-lethal weapon, so it would clear a room or it would disperse a crowd, that sort of thing. So, pepper spray is something you can buy commercially. So it's along lines, only sort of a sustainable, locally grown version of it, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, your book also incorporates humor to tell all these stories. How does that help?
Well, actually, in this case, it was a bit of a challenge because of the subject matter. You know, I'm known as a funny writer of sorts. And so in this case, the humor, I tend to poke fun at myself more than, and it's not humor at other people's expense so much as at myself for being kind of the clueless, bumbling outsider, which I very much was because I have no military experience. It was a foreign culture to me, and I don't really speak the language. And for example, I was at Aberdeen Proving Ground where they were testing. They were working on developing a crash test dummy for vehicles that may drive over explosives, and they were showing this to me, and they were explaining how it's a very pared down vehicle because if you're going to add weight to a vehicle like that, it goes into protective elements, not, a microwave oven or a bathroom. And I said to them, "Oh, well, they're saying it's very bare in here. It's just sort of seats and that's it." And I said, "Oh, but it's nice that you have some cup holders." And the guy just looks at me like I'm just the biggest idiot he's ever met. He goes, "Oh, Mary, those are rifle holders." So I'm just not really always knowing what's going on. And sometimes the historical material, like the shark repellent chapter, there's opportunities for humor there. But in general, a little bit more of a challenge with this book because it is, you know, we are ultimately talking about war.
And we will get into some of these curious science aspects that you explored. Like, I mean, the chicken gun. What is the chicken gun?
Well, the chicken gun is it's a kind of a heavy artillery piece that is used for firing defrosted supermarket chickens. And
what?
The reason
what?
That you're firing them at, say, a jet canopy to make sure it's for bird strike, which is when a plane hits a bird in the air and it damages the plane, sometimes causes the plane to crash, like in the case of the Captain Sully's plane, so the famous example of bird strike. So in order to test the components of a jet, there's this gun that fires chickens. And chickens are an odd choice in that they don't actually fly, and they're actually quite dense compared to birds that do fly or that float on water. So it's kind of a worst-case scenario, I guess, was the decision. And chicken is something that can be easily standardized, and this is a, you know, as a testing device, they want to have a standardized bullet, as it were. So that's the chicken gun.
And so are they still, I mean, was this just an experiment or now it's over? What, or do they still use the chicken gun?
As far as I know, they still, it's a standard test. It's something that's done, as far as I know, that they're still using chicken guns. It's a large piece of equipment, and the chickens are easy to come by, so they just bring in the piece of the plane or jet and fire away.
We are talking with Mary Roach. She is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. We're talking about some of this curious science, some of these experiments, research that the military conducted, not to... You know, not on bombs and weapons and how to kill, rather on things that will help keep people alive. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions, your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So in more of a in more general terms, Mary Roach, what, I mean, besides the research on weapons and strategy, give us an idea of the other types of science, this curious science. Why is the military doing this?
Well, this is science that looks into how to mitigate all of the hardships of being in combat. So in other words, it's science that looks at extreme heat, for example, or heavy loads, or sleep deprivation, exhaustion, panic and stress, all of the things that a soldier or Marine has to deal with in an extreme way in combat, which is it's a very intense scenario to put a human body into. So it's those topics and that sort of thing. Even things like flies, which you can imagine in a military setting, particularly historically, you'd have these large field camps with out in the middle of a field in the heat, and you've got food, you've got bodies, you've got open pit toilets. I mean, it's a sort of a cornucopia for flies, and these intense numbers of flies would gather and breed, things that people don't necessarily think about when they think about combat, all of the sort of everyday, if you will, hardships of war.
Speaking of flies, and this is really gross, but the military did research on how maggots can help the wounds of war?
Yes, it's called maggot therapy today. It started in World War I. There was a surgeon, William Baer, who in France, who noticed there were a couple of soldiers who came in with large wounds. They'd been lying in the field for a number of days. They came in and they had maggots in these wounds, and of course people were horrified and got rid of the maggots, took them out. And what Dr. Baer noticed is that, in fact, these wounds were not infected. They seemed to be healing really well. There was this healthy pink tissue growing in. And he saw this over and over, and he came to realize that what the maggots do, maggots, as we know, prefer dead flesh. So they perform a kind of debridement, which is important. I mean, if you have a tremendous wound and you come into a hospital, they're going to do that surgically. They're going to remove dead tissue or infected tissue. They're going to get rid of that. And the maggots selectively were doing that. And they were preventing infection. It was very counterintuitive. You know, people associate them with filth, but in fact they were encouraging healing. And Dr. Baer, later in civilian life, actually decided to try it out on some patients for whom the more standard treatment hadn't worked, and the infection was recurring. So and to this day, maggot therapy is used. It's often used with diabetics who have these ulcers on their feet that are very slow to heal, and the maggots work quite well. The maggot is a FDA-approved medical device.
Isn't that something?
There's a Medicare reimbursement code for the maggot.
An FDA-approved maggot. So a lot of the science that started in the military is now used in everyday life.
Yes, yeah, particularly in the medical realm, there's a lot of advancements that have come along through work that was done by the military, the Navy. One of them in particular is something that no one gives much thought to. There was a Navy captain, Captain Phillips, who realized when somebody is dehydrated from diarrhea, from a enteric disease, he realized that if you add glucose to these rehydration fluids, which, you know, have salts and minerals, if you added glucose to that, now the patient could drink those rehydration fluids rather than be hooked up to an IV. And that meant you didn't have to make your way to a clinic and be, given a medical procedure to get rehydrated. It could be just something that you open up and drink. And this was mentioned in The Lancet, said that was, you know, possibly in terms of lives saved, one of the most important medical breakthroughs of the century. And I mean, diarrhea still kills, millions of people, particularly in developing nations and among children. So that, you know, that's a, and it used to be in military conflicts, the number of people killed by dysentery, which is a very extreme kind of diarrhea, by dysentery outnumbered the people killed by bullets and bombs by a quite surprising degree. So the military had a strategic need for something like that to keep people alive. But it's, of course, now come into civilian practice and has saved many, many lives.
We are talking with Mary Roach. She is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And we're welcoming your questions, maybe even some examples that you know of, research that has led to some advances in medicine or technology or things to help people that came from our military. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So are you in the military, or have you been in the military? What do you know about the science that the military is involved in? Maybe you've been a part of a scientific experiment. We are talking about the curious science of humans at war with Mary Roach, who is a science writer and the author of many books about science, including her latest, Grunt, which is about science conducted by the military, and primarily the science conducted by the military to help people, to save lives, not take lives. Well, we have some callers, so let's go to Victor in West Allis. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Joy. It's been a while since I talked to you.
Yeah.
Hey, I was wondering any improvements. When I was in the Navy from 62 to 65, I served 2 years on a destroyer. And one of my five jobs in the Navy was a swimmer, which is going after pilots that, we say, flamed out, and they try to land near a destroyer as close as possible. The only thing is, when you got up there, you threw a shark die, and when you see a dorsal come flying by or a fin, it just sends shivers up your spine as you're trying to get the pilot out, if it can't get out of the plane or he's just floating on the raft. I was wondering, any improvements done on the shark die?
Shark die?
Yeah, it's a dye you throw in the water.
Yes, shark dye was I have a chapter on that dye. It was originally they called it shark chaser, and it was the result of a quite lengthy program to figure out is there any way to repel shark, and they tried numerous compounds. Of course, the challenge is if anything you put into the ocean is going to quickly dilute to the point where it's not much help, and including a dye. The dye was found, that was the thing that worked the best, and so that's what they used, and it would buy you some time, but I don't feel there wasn't a ton of confidence in that. But the good news, the cheerful thing here is that the other thing that the military learned from all of its shark research, they did a tremendous amount, the Office of Navy Research, on what attracts and repels sharks, and how common are these attacks. The International Shark Attack File, if you look at the numbers of attacks, it's very, very small, and in fact there are very, very few instances blood does not seem to attract them. There's that story you hear about one molecule of blood, a shark can sense that, smell it, and come straight for you. But there are very, very few instances where someone's been bit once and then more sharks have come. So it seems to be that seems to be a myth. And in fact, the shark attacks are so rare. There were if you look at the numbers, it's a very, very rare. Even in the times that they during the period after World War II, when they were. But during World War II, when they're trying to develop a repellent, the Navy hadn't lost anybody to a shark attack at that time. It was more of what they called a pink pill. It was something to make you feel more confident, because there was a lot of problems with morale in flyers and sailors, people who might need to ditch or abandon ship into these warmer waters that they were in World War II. So it was a in order to counter the problem with sort of shark panic and shark hysteria, they went into this line of research. But I spoke to a guy who was a videographer that has specialized in sharks, and I said, what would your advice be to someone's in the water and sees a shark? And he said, enjoy the experience. Because they're amazing creatures. But but after the development of shark chaser and the dye, I don't know that the military, they came up with it. There was a screen they tested that you could sort of, being in a little open top barrel that you would erect around yourself. So there were a few other products, and there've been some commercial things, but I think that for the most part, it was a fear that was over-exaggerated in people's minds.
Here's a question for you. Why are zippers a problem for snipers?
Well, somebody whose job may entail lying on one's belly for extended periods of time, if you have a top, a jacket, or shirt with buttons or zippers, that's an uncomfortable thing to lie on. And that's so... For that reason, if you look at this outfit, I was at Natick Labs in Massachusetts. Natick does the clothing and the tents and all of the kind of accessories of combat. This top has a side closure. There's the front of it is very flat. There's actually a fashion design team for the military. And so they moved the closing device over to the side for that reason. I wondered, why couldn't you use Velcro? And the designer explained that Velcro is loud.
Oh,
so if
yeah.
you're in an environment where you don't want to be heard, or you don't want people to know that you're there, if you don't want to be having something that's going to go you have to open it, whether you know whether it's a pocket or the garment itself. Velcro is not so popular. They're working on one of the things that they're the folks at Natick on their to-do list is a stealthier Velcro.
Quiet Velcro. That's
quiet Velcro. Yeah.
And talk about the research when it comes to protective textiles. What exactly are protective textiles?
Well, protective textile, it's something that might protect you from many things at once, and that's why it's scientifically complicated and tricky. You have a fabric that, okay, so you want it, one of the basic things you want in a military garment, it's some sort of flame resistance, so that if you're exposed to fire or an explosion, your garment isn't going to ignite. So flame resistance is important. So that's something that you can treat the textile, say. Now you've also got, if in the case of a chemical or biological attack, you would have a textile that would be super shedding, is how they term it. So something with where water or water beads, not just water beads up and rolls off, but things like aviation fuel or alcohols or things that chemical weapons, things, anything you throw at it, it's going to bead up and roll off. So that's an important feature to have, particularly if you're in any sort of risky environment for that. You also want, perhaps you'd like to have it repel mosquitoes and insects that transmit disease. So that's another kind of a treatment you'd have to do. The fabric, the tricky part, and the thing that they deal with at Natick, Natick Labs, is creating a fabric where all of these different components will work well together, and something that when you throw it in the army laundry, it's not going to wash off. So it's got to withstand a couple of hundred washes. So you've got that problem as well. So it's a very, very tricky.
We could use those mosquito repellent, pieces of clothing now with all the Zika and other mosquito-borne illnesses.
Yeah, and you do see these treatments like permethrin, which is a fabric treatment that repels mosquitoes. That you see that in outdoor clothing stores. So that's, of course, something that's
that is
made
currently
its way into the civilian sphere. Yeah.
We are talking with Mary Roach. She is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You might remember her previous books, including Gulp and Stiff. Well, if you have any reactions to some of the curious science of the military that you're hearing, give us a call. Or maybe you have an example of some research that the military is doing or has done. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Ron in Ironwood, Michigan is with us now. Hello, Ron.
Yes, good morning. I love your show. I listen regularly. And I like Mary this morning. She's fascinating.
Good.
Thanks.
I had an example, a story that I wanted to share from my own dad was a career civil service employee. And one of the places he worked was in White Sands, New Mexico in the 6585th test group. And one of the things they have is a 10-mile test track. It's like highly engineered railroad tracks that are 10 miles long. And they put sleds on there, and they put rocket engines behind the sleds, and at very high speed, they run tests. And one of the tests that I found fascinating, every now and then visitors were allowed out to watch a test, and actually from our house with binoculars or telescope, we could see the track. But anyway, one of the fascinating tests to me was on ejection seats for fighter jets, because when a jet is shot down or just has a problem, and whether it's a pilot error or a mechanical, we want to save that pilot. And so in older technology, sometimes when the pilot would eject, he would not clear the aircraft safely. So the manufacturers would build a mock-up of the cockpit, put it on this lid, launch it down the track at 500 or 600 miles an hour, eject a dummy on a super high-speed camera, and frame by frame see exactly what was going wrong, and fix it so that the canopy is blown completely clear before the pilot is launched out, so that the pilot can be safe. And I just, it's so fascinating how much high-tech effort, energy, and time is put in to just making these pilots safer.
Mm. Well, that sounds like worthwhile research, Mary.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I wondered if you saw a Colonel Stapp through your binoculars at any point. He was this amazing guy who did a lot of that work with the test track. In his case, not a dummy, but himself. He would ride the sled himself. They were looking at not just ejection seats, but automotive safety. Because if you're in a crash and you stop suddenly, you're thrown forward. So you can mimic those forces with this type of sled that Ron is talking about, and for some of the survivable speeds, Colonel Stapp would get on there himself, and his eyeballs would pop out of his head partway, and he took broken bones. A number of these guys, tremendous sacrifices. They were really amazing what they put themselves through, and this was the beginnings of automotive safety. When we're looking at development of seatbelts and airbags, all of that grew out of this early work with some of it was done also for NASA for the space program, looking at when a space capsule splashes down, or the initial acceleration, the sudden acceleration when you launch in a rocket. So all of this sudden stopping and starting is very hard on the body. And with an ejection seat, even just that suddenly being ejected, they had to test with that sudden acceleration from the cockpit. Was that going to be dangerous? Is that going to break limbs? What would that do to the body? So they. And some of the guys would be recruited, and they'd be paid hazard pay. They'd get a little like $15 extra, and they were obviously being used for the smaller amounts of force. But it was really fascinating work. There was every year they published these proceedings of the Stapp Car Crash Conference. And I remember coming across that in the basement of a medical school library, and that was kind of what got me interested in my first book, Stiff.
We have a tweet from Andrea, who wants to know, what is the wackiest or the most interesting research that you came across while working on the book?
I guess the most interesting thing that I came across, and something that I really wasn't anticipating at all, when I was at Walter Reed Hospital, Military Medical Center, and I was in the operating room. They were doing some work repairing someone's urethra. I was reporting on genital injuries, which are more of a problem these days because the bombs have gotten bigger and the medical care has gotten better and faster. So people are surviving to have injuries much higher up than they used to. And I said to the surgeon, "What's on the horizon? What's new?" And he explained that the one thing the military had been funding was some work in actual transplantation, penis transplantation. And I went, what? This was the first I'd heard. And in fact, the first American transplant happened a couple months ago. So that was, that was something I'd never heard of and had never knew that anybody was thinking even about it. And lo and behold, it's come to pass. And that's a tremendous advantage because now you have the whole organ that can do the functions that those organs are meant to do, whereas when you rebuild them, there's not really anything you can put in there that mimics erectile tissue. So that's been a challenge. You have to have implants, sort of inflatable, saline inflatable implants. Anyway, so if you could take the whole organ and reattach the arteries and the veins and the nerves and everything works, that's pretty amazing for people who, and not just for veterans, but I think the first person ended up being in a different place than I was at, and it was a cancer patient, not a veteran.
Oh, but you say the military was doing the research in part because of the traumatic injuries that occur in war.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And more so today with the types of weapons that, you know, the buried explosives that somebody might step on a sensor plate and the whole thing goes off right there underneath them. So that's an injury that you didn't see quite so much in previous conflicts.
I know that you wrote about training for combat medics while reporting for the book. And talk some about that. And what is a cut suit?
Sure. Yeah, a cut suit. Well, if you're familiar with Resusca-Anne, you know, there are these patient simulators. It's a pretend patient that emergency medical personnel can train on, and they've gotten quite sophisticated. And the cut suit is a wearable version of that. It's a huge suit you put it on and you look like a very stocky person. And that's because there's an abdomen that has organs in it. So it's not real organs, obviously, but very realistic organs. The suit bleeds. It's got a blood supply similar to the amount of blood that the human body has. It's got a collar you can put over the neck so that somebody can practice cutting an emergency airway if someone's struggling to breathe. So there are these medical procedures, I mean, bleeding out, as they say, bleeding to death, or being unable to breathe because you've been shot in the chest through the lung. Those are the two primary causes of combat death. So both of those things can be practiced with this cut suit. And so, and it tends to be done, there are these hyper-realistic military scenarios, combat scenarios, where somebody will be wearing a cut suit. They may have amputee actors come in, and they put over their stump a latex sleeve with very realistic gore, if you will, and it really looks as though the person has just had a lower leg blown off. The back, they've got a backpack with stage blood that has a pump, and so the stump would be bleeding at a realistic rate, and there's the same sort of amount of blood. So the trainee, whether it's a medic or a Navy corpsman, those are the people who give care to the Marines in combat. The person would be introduced into this scenario with this screaming, very upset person with the leg that's been blown off. You've got pyrotechnics and loud noises and dust hits to make it look like this is real rifle fire. The instructor is shouting at you. The whole idea is to create some of the stress that you are going to encounter in a real combat situation if you're a medic. So, and you're going to have to be doing these detailed medical procedures in a stress environment where you've got the fight or flight response, which is great if you're fleeing or fighting, but otherwise it doesn't serve you well. It's a great, it kind of makes you fast and strong, but dumb. You know, you don't have this sort of, you know, your judgment is impaired. You've got sort of tunnel vision. You're not really aware of your surroundings. Your hands are shaking. So it really works against you if you need to stay put and render medical care or you know, do something as complex as cutting a new airway. You can't just sort of lose your head when you do that. So these medics and medical personnel are put through this kind of a training, and it's not a fun day for them, but you really do see them over the course of 2 days be more confident and calm when they're doing what they need to be doing. So, you know, hopefully they call it stress inoculation, and you kind of give them a little dose of what they might be dealing with in a real situation, and hopefully when the actual scenario unfolds, they'll be a little better equipped to deal with that panic and stress that they may be feeling.
We are talking with New York Times bestselling author Mary Roach about her latest book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And we are talking about the science that the military conducts to help military members, to help save lives. And some of this research also makes its way into the civilian realm. And we are welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your reactions. Wondering if you're aware of any of this military research. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Mary Roach. She is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Many of us are familiar that the military has been involved in lots of scientific research when it comes to weapons or strategy or killing. We are talking about some of the more unusual, curious, and life-saving or life-improving research that has been conducted by the military. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have Svensson Books on Twitter asking, did you learn about any military science that didn't work for the military but had other applications for civilians? Okay, that's Svensson Books is asking that. So anything that didn't work for the military but is working for civilians, Mary?
Well, the thing that came to mind was a fascinating, unusual effort during World War II to develop a foul smell that could be used for resistance groups could use this to humiliate officers. Okay, so if these would be motivated citizens who are trying to help out in the war effort, and the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, came up with this idea that you'd give people little tubes that were squirtable and it had this heinous smell, and you would spray it on the uniform of this officer that you saw on the street or wherever you saw this officer. And the idea was that there'd be no backfire, there'd be nothing that would mark you. You would be able to just squirt it onto the enemy. And a lot of work went into figuring out what was the most unappealing, humiliating, awful stink. And also, you know, how do we, the delivery system. And a number of years this was devoted to this work. There were a lot of problems with backfire and dribble. They had to put a little hand shield on. There was a lot of complaining among the laboratory staff that was testing it. But this notion, and it never, in fact, this little substance, SAC-23 was the code name, it was never deployed. There were so many problems with it. And then in the end, the final report came out a few days before the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So the war ended before this stink device was ever even deployed or distributed. But the notion of a bad smell as a non-lethal weapon, something you could use to clear a compound or disperse an angry mob or deal with people in a way that wasn't harmful but would make things temporarily very unpleasant for them, that is carried on. And there are there has been work more recently to develop there's something called stench soup, which is has deemed to be a universally loathed smell, something that in any culture you can present this and people will not only be repulsed, but they'll be afraid because it's a weird, it combines both a bad smell and also there's a little bit of a fruity smell to it. So, and their idea there was that you would have because when people encounter a new smell, they tend to be tentative and they take a small whiff. So you have the top note is sort of pleasant. And then that encourages people on the keeper inhale, as they call it, to take a big inhale to really fill the nose. And then they get this exposure to this very, very unpleasant smell, and the basis of that was something called U.S. government standard bathroom malodor. And that was designed, that product was designed for testing latrine deodorants in World War II. They had to have a standardized bad latrine smell that they could use to test these deodorizers to see if they helped. So they came up with this, you could you can buy, I believe, U.S. government standard bathroom mallet or something you can get from some of these flavor and fragrance companies, should you so desire.
Yeah, but anyway. Sounds like a great practical joke, huh? But, you know, something came to mind about what's being used a lot in the civilian realm that reminded me of the cover of your book. You have an army soldier with this massive backpack on, or lots of equipment, because our military members have to put a lot on their backs as they're out in combat. But I'm thinking of all things camping equipment, and my husband was shopping for things to put on his bike so he could carry a tent and a sleeping bag and a this and a that, all in very tiny, compact and lightweight ways. I'm guessing that came from our military to have that kind of equipment.
Yes, The military were kind of the original backpackers.
Mm-hmm.
They were going into regions where there was nowhere to buy food. You had to carry your food and water and your clothing. So backpacks, think about jeeps and four wheel drive and those inflatable rafts that you take down the river. We mentioned earlier the permethrin, that mosquito repellent treatment for clothing. That's a military development. Gore-Tex, I believe, is military. Things like dehydrated food, dehydrated coffee, that sort of the dehydration technology came out of the military. Foods that last a long time that don't spoil. Camping foods that you buy those packets of, that sort of thing. So yeah, absolutely. Those sorts of products. Often the military doesn't invent them, but they fund the private industry that develops them and then creates them. So they sort of put the need out there, and people, companies bid to get the contract, and then they develop the product, so they sort of push it along certain roads, if you will. They don't actually do the inventing themselves, but sometimes they do. But anyway, but yes, absolutely, camping and outdoor equipment is one of those examples.
John in Duluth, Minnesota is with us. Hello, John.
Hi. I was a medic with an infantry company in Vietnam, wounded in 1970, and three of the people I was with were killed, and a bunch of stuff going on, and so that was very stressful. Also, a few years ago, I was back at Fort Sam Houston, where the medics are trained, and we got a tour, myself and a bunch of other medics, got a tour of the facility, and I was amazed at the improvement in training, also one that's come from Vietnam or before, is the idea of an evacuation helicopter, which you see fairly commonly now. So I just thought you'd like to know that.
Thank you for sharing that. So he sees that training is much better now for medics. Mary?
Yeah. I wonder what it was, what they did in the Vietnam era for training. Is he still on the line?
Unfortunately, he did hang up, yeah.
It's interesting, I mentioned those simulations with the amputee actors and the cut suit. There's also, there are other things that are done that are kind of interesting. They'll sometimes the trainees will spend time in an emergency room in a really tough neighborhood where there are knifings and bullet wounds, automatic weapons wounds, similar to what you might, things that you might see in a combat scenario. So sometimes they'll spend time training there. There's also a controversial practice called live tissue training, where the livestock, like a pig or a goat, is anesthetized, a leg will be cut off, and they'll have to learn how to stop the bleeding. You have a couple of minutes if somebody's got an artery that's cut. Kind of training is for people who've been through it. They're very defensive when people come and say that this sort of training should be stopped. So you can imagine it's not popular in the animal rights community, but that's another way training is done. So it's evolving over the years. It's evolving now more towards simulators and cut suits and things like we talked about earlier, and away from the live anesthetized animals. But it's an interesting challenge. You know, how do you practice something like cutting an airway or you know, stopping an artery from bleeding if you don't have a tourniquet right at hand? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do? Yeah.
I'm not sure what to make of this tweet from William, who says that the military has advanced technology that people use forever, and he thinks that's unfortunate. Do you think that any of these technical advancements have been bad for us?
Well, I'm not sure what he's referring to. I mean, I don't think that the things we've talked about today have been bad. I think some of those things have been quite good, particularly in medical care. But without knowing what
it's
he's
kind of
referring to, it's hard to say.
Well, let's in your introduction, you wrote, "Sometimes courage is nothing more than a willingness to think differently than those around you." What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that in a whether it's a corporation or the military, you're encouraged to sort of toe the line and do what everyone else is doing. And if, say, you have an idea, like, for example, I think the example I give later in that chapter, if you have this idea that, okay, people are dying, people are bleeding to death all around you in a combat zone, and you think to yourself, because this is the beginnings of when blood transfusion was first being practiced, and you have this idea, what if you could take the blood from these people who've just died? You could use that blood, because getting blood where it's needed on the front was a tremendous challenge. You know, the Army blood supply system is quite elaborate. There's caches of blood in secret places, and you know, keeping enough blood where it's needed has always been difficult. So someone had this idea, well, what if you could take the blood from someone who's just died? You could take that blood and transfuse it. And, you know, you're talking about taking cadaver blood and transfusing it, which is possible. You know, there's a window of opportunity. But if you can imagine, there's a lot of resistance. Like, that seemed horrific. That seemed like, you know, how could you possibly do that? You know, or someone saying, you know, we're seeing people dying of snake bite. There's a lot of concern with, you know, cobras, with the conflict in the, you know, in Asia. Okay, what if we were to, like, what if somebody were to see if we could systematically expose somebody to very small amounts of it and build up an immune response? What if we could do that? Well, that seems like a crazy idea, but there was an Army captain who did that on himself. So that's what I meant. It's you know, it's like going to your superior or whoever and saying, hey, I have an idea. What if I just, you know, inject myself with some cobra venom and see how that works? You know, these things that seem crazy, but in fact may save lives.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Mary Roach is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And thank you to producers Brianne Shasso and Kai Brito. Thanks as well for production work today from Bill Martins and Nyasia Ellison. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different perspectives talking about the top stories in politics this week. That's the Week in Review every Friday from 8 until 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.